Used to be different.
From New York City,
the Comedy Cellar and Rethink Production present
Live from America Podcast.
We will make America great again.
How about new?
You crazy Dutch bastard.
Live from America Podcast.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
No. Excuse me. Just so you understand.
We can't be the stupid country anymore.
Live from America Podcast.
I believe we can keep the promise of our founding. The idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you look like, or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white, or Hispanic, or Asian, or Native American, or young or old, or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
It's just words, folks. It's just words.
This is Live from America Podcast with Noam Dorman and Haddon Gabb.
All right. Hello and welcome to Live from America Podcast from the Comedy Cellar, New York City. We have Modi,
yeah.
Comedian Modi's back from the Jew tour. Is it done yet or are you still
alive? I'm done. It was done last week already.
Nice. And comedian Lou Perez. Comedian Dan Natterman.
Hello.
Welcome back. And the return of one of our favorite guests, Michel Paradis. He is the senior attorney for the Department of Defense. Welcome back. It's been a while.
And a Columbia Thank professor.
That's right.
Yeah. And Noam Dorman, of course.
Michel's name does not match his voice.
Really?
But Michel Paradis, I thought maybe you'd talk
Michel Paradis, I should talk like Ariel Sharon.
That's a pretty good
impression. Where'd Hatem
go? Yeah, I'm right here. So Starbucks is going to close for one day, guys. Can you handle it, Dan?
I never go to Starbucks, but I would love to be a fly on the wall. I want to know what this racial sensitivity training is all about.
Yeah.
Is every Starbucks closing?
In the country.
What day?
I'm not sure.
May
I'll
29th?
Ask Dunkin' Donuts.
I think it's May 29th.
May 29th?
Yeah,
September 11th.
What about overseas Starbucks? Because it's an international chain.
That's a great... Yeah. Do they care about black people only internationally or nationally? Well, you need to know that. So what is the training going to be?
Well, what we're dying to find out. We should have had on a sensitivity trainer on the show.
No, what do you think is going to be? Like if you want to have a sensitivity training
doesn't
for...
No, doesn't do that. It's at the Olive
for business.
It's just... Bullshit. Come on. They don't need to close to do this.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it to try to inoculate themselves against the boycott culture, which they see coming. And this is a smart move, I guess.
Do you think the black employees are going to be forced to go to these racial sensitivity training?
It's a good question.
Yeah. And if they're late, are they going to like yell at them or...
There's a lot of chance.
Oh, okay, train me.
Okay, we're going to close the podcast for one day to train.
I think you need the black employees there for the role-playing exercises that will inevitably come up.
The act-outs.
The role-play, that will be, that's funny.
I would love to know what it entails. Probably, it's probably going to be role-playing, okay, Darnell.
Whoa.
What?
Okay, go ahead, Grant.
Well, I had to use a name that's,
Go ahead, yeah.
I'm just saying that it was probably like, okay, Darnell, now come and ask Chad, to use the bathroom.
Wait, are they making the white guy Darnell just for the role-playing?
Actually they are.
Oh, wow. That's going to be interesting.
But, so they'll do that kind of stuff. Okay, now how did it make you feel when Chad told you it's for customers only? I would imagine it'd be that...
We had a 7-Eleven opened up by my house, and it's a corporate 7-Eleven, so they do the training for the employees there. And so you see, like, when there's a guy behind them, and you come to the counter, and like, was that all you'll be having? Did you see the pizza? They're very this and that. Uh-huh. And then there's Jamaican guy, like with the real Jamaican guy with the thing and the hair and the in the big hat, and and he's trying
sexy.
To do, and he's trying to do the whole thing, and he's like, and I go, this is it, and he goes, that all you want. That all you want.
Oh, Modi. Anyway.
It's been funny.
Listen, I think that all over the country now, this is kind of serious for Starbucks because every color, but black guys are going to walk into Starbucks now, sit down, order nothing, take a pee, and say, and basically, I dare you, right? Yeah. I'm not sure Starbucks is playing this the right way. I think Starbucks could have said, I mean, we don't know the details. That's the thing. Maybe you guys do. I haven't read it all.
I think it's good for the rest of the business because somebody come to your business and is like, I want to use the bathroom. You're like, Starbucks is around the corner.
Thank you.
That was comedian.
That's the best one you've ever told.
Thank you.
No, he had it last week. Last week when he said, I'm going to make the documentary, The Making of 9/11. That was pretty
good. That was off the air, dummy.
That was really good.
That was very good.
Really? Why can't you do that?
I'm going to do it tonight at 11:45 downstairs is when I'm doing that.
But from what I hear about it, this Korean lady, you know, she was doing her job. You can't just sit there and order.
Oh, she was Korean?
Oh, that changes.
Ooh, I didn't know that.
That's what somebody told me.
I thought it was a white manager. It was a manager.
It was a white manager.
But I didn't know it was Korean manager.
Somebody told me she was Asian.
Could be. Whatever.
That makes sense. They really hate the blacks.
Yeah, they don't love them.
But listen, we don't let people come in the olive tree and use the bathroom and sit down. And we don't.
You say so that now.
Now, we don't call the cops because I know that calling the cops is a beginning of an uncontrollable situation, a situation that could spin out of control. And so I just know not to call the cops. However, they have the right to call the cops, and the cops should not have arrested these people, I don't think. They're going to arrest somebody. Just get them out.
Well, I think they had, and again, I don't know the details either, but I think they had refused to. I think the cops said, you guys got to go. They don't want you here. You're trespassing. And the guys were like, no, we're not going. At which point, I guess you have to arrest them.
I don't think you have to arrest them, but.
Yeah, well, you have to physically, at a minimum, you have to physically, if indeed that's what happened, you have to physically remove them.
This is in Philly, too, right?
It was in Philly.
So I wonder if that changes the dynamic a little bit. I don't know what.
Because everybody just assumes Philly cops are real bad, right? Right. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think so.
Were the cops black? No.
You know, one of them might have been. I'm not sure. I don't know. But
we're doing a podcast on the topic that no one knows all the details.
But what is exactly what
we can make up some interesting details.
Yeah, well, the Korean angle was great.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
It was great.
But you know, if Starbucks, any restaurant has a right to toss you, or if you're not ordering. Now they might let white. But the issue is do they let their white customers sit there and not order?
Apparently, there was a woman who said that the day before she just went to the bathroom and didn't order anything.
Right.
But which is, seems like a very weird thing to admit, but, you know. Just
but even
person.
If that's the case, even if they let white people do that.
Well, actually, can I admit something as a affluent white male? Is when we were having our apartment renovated, we didn't have a bathroom to use. And so I just went across the street to the Starbucks.
Wow. No showering one. In a Starbucks.
Thing. I didn't shower in the Starbucks. We didn't have a toilet. And so I had to.
Would you shower?
Well, I'll tell you a story. It has nothing to do with Starbucks. I had to go real bad number two, and I went to NYU Law, and I said, "Dude," I said, "you know, you gotta, you know." He said, "No, you're not a student here. You can't go."
But you were a student there once, no?
I was a student at Fordham, but this was years later.
Sorry.
Okay, the cop who arrested them, the cop was in charge, was black. He said, and if you think about it, any business calls someone that I hear no longer wish to be in my office, we have a legal obligation. Ross, who's black, references his own experiences while making a case, saying, as an African-American male, I'm very aware of implicit bias, but he doesn't feel the police did anything wrong.
But there's two issues. Did the police do something wrong? When you're called to an establishment and the owner says, I don't want these people here, they're trespassers. The cops remove them.
Look, can I tell you my experience? I got sued by a black customer and paid a settlement, $1,500. I might have told you this story before.
I don't think so.
Okay, Friday night, Friday afternoons in the Fat Black Pussycat, we have happy hour. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's 85 to 90% black customers. Our door staff is 100% black. There's no white person anywhere in this story. Some black customers came to the door, and I don't know who they were or what, and Big Steve King, for whatever reason, decided not to let them in. Now, he'd already let in 200 black customers. It's not. And this guy sued, and I settled. I am keenly aware that these things are impossible to decipher. And we just don't know. We just don't know. I think that without any further information, if somebody comes in and wants to use the bathroom, we don't let people use the bathroom if they're not customers. White, black, brown, and they're almost always white, actually, right, in the village, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And sometimes the truth is the bartenders get overzealous. They're like, just let them use the stupid bathroom, like, you know, but they don't. And certainly nobody can just sit down and not order. So you imagine. Well,
first of all, the comedy sellers, like you.
No, it's about an olive tree.
Yeah.
But you presume that Starbucks maybe had a particular problem with this kind of thing. Not every Starbucks is the same. In Ardsley, they're not worried about people coming in and just hanging out there all day. But
I've gone into places
Philly,
and
they
bought
were.
A soda, bought something just so I can use the bathroom.
Well, I was going to say, but we all kind of know that if you go into a place and you're just going to sit down, you order a bottle of water or something.
Right.
Yeah. And so, I wonder, yeah.
Meanwhile, at the olive tree, the bathroom, just so you people who haven't been here, the olive tree, the bathroom is on the stage of the comedy cellar. You have to walk in, you have to become a part of the act of the comedian to go to the bathroom. You have to go through the comedy cellar to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. So I'm just tired of the reflexive position of cowering that everybody does when they get accused of something. You know, defend yourself. No, it wasn't racist. If it wasn't, I don't know. There is racism, after all.
So why'd you settle?
It would have been more expensive to fight it. Probably.
No, because it would have gotten in the papers. Maybe it was so absurd. I just wanted to be. Ever since then, like I thought, what if I ever want to go into politics? Like now, there's a thing. Like, oh, he settled a $1,500.
No, but I'm sure you had them sign that they could never discuss this. And
I just paid the fine to the Human Rights Commission of the City of New York.
Wow,
it's insanity.
Well, on the Starbucks, what I wonder about the Starbucks thing is that, you know, somehow emblematic of other instances with Starbucks? Because it seems like this is the first thing that I've ever heard about happening at Starbucks. So it seems like overkill to close all of the stores down if it's one incident.
It's just, you know, for show.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're the CEO of Starbucks, Dom, and just based on what you know, what is the statement that you make?
Oh, I shut the stores down and I have
2 days of it. 2 day shutdown.
And pay every black person $1,500.
I would just change the logo to a black woman, you know, that thing.
A black mermaid.
Yeah. You know, it was a big deal in the Middle East that Starbucks is a Jewish corporation. I don't know if you guys know that.
The founder is.
No,
CEO.
Is that true?
Yeah. No. It's true they say that the
doesn't mean the whole company is Jew.
The logo is a Jewish thing.
Symbol. Well, here you guys go again.
No,
with your conspiracy.
No, I'm not saying conspiracy. I'm telling you what's actually going on in the Middle East. They don't like Starbucks for that reason.
Starbucks bit the big one in Israel. It didn't do well in Israel.
Yeah.
Because the coffee in Israel is so good, and when people are like, the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Like, ugh.
It's true. Yeah.
Well, Starbucks is amazingly inconsistent. It didn't used to be, but now it's like half the time
awful.
When it's good, it's good.
So in Israel, it's just bomb. People are like, I want a good cup of coffee. I don't want this.
I like their morning bun, but I'm not a coffee drinker.
So,
but can I actually come back to something you said, Noam, is that I think what I don't know a thing about this controversy other than what you've all just said, but what kind of at least sticks out in my mind is that they called the police to get two guys out of the store. And that does begin to make me think of, okay, is the perceived threat that a manager at Starbucks sees when he sees two black kids different or extreme or overwrought compared to, you know, some NYU student in the village who's just trying to pee in your bathroom?
I think
that's kind of what you said, right? Like, why would you call the police? When you call the police, it becomes an uncontrollable situation. And that does, I don't know.
No,
it's at least something
to
know.
I'm
going to
tell you as a boss. First of all, it's unknowable. Second of all, I've seen my black door guys, I've had this incident, not in a long time, that some guy was smoking a cigarette. It's against the law to smoke in a bar. Calls the cops. I said, what are you calling the cops? He was smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you know, it's no hurry. Let him finish his cigarette. Don't serve him. He'll leave. You know, like, why are you going? So you don't understand how employees, it's like run, Forrest, run. they don't use the best judgment all the time. They get frustrated. It becomes personal. They ask somebody to do something. The customer, this is how hot something I got. they get into a personal battle of wills with this customer. and they don't want to stand down, and it escalates and say, fuck this guy, I'm calling the cops. And that's how it spins out of control. So I taught my employees, I don't want anybody calling the cops unless it's imminent danger to life or limb or property. Otherwise, you just wait it out. Don't serve them. But that's not the way. And still, they don't always listen.
But here, I'm going to defend it reluctantly, but nevertheless, defend the implicit bias training there. Is that when you say, look, only call the cops when it gets dangerous. Does a store clerk, does a white store clerk have a hair trigger in a situation where it's a black customer?
And I have no idea.
In terms of perception of danger.
Well, you'd have to talk
right?
to...
Because because we do know that the police are much more apt to shoot...
No, we don't know that. We don't know that.
No, we do.
No, we don't. We don't.
The resort to force. No, we do. They've done. They've
not
done
according to the stats.
They have done stats.
No,
the resort to force under like circumstances happens faster in cases of black suspects, even with black cops. Like it's not. We're not talking Jim Crow kind
but
of stuff.
No, that is not. I've read extensively about this, and according to a black economist at Harvard. And all the stats that Andrew Sullivan has been writing about, inexplicably, like I would have thought that was true, the cops are not more likely to shoot black guys. This is what the stats say.
And it's two different things,
You've
too.
Seen that too, right?
Yeah, it's two different things, too. Like you said, like resorting to force, that has to be differentiated from shooting.
So the ones that I saw,
apparently a white guy is more likely to be shot by a cop. Now, on the resorting to force, I'm not sure what.
They are more likely to be arrested wrongly.
Sure,
they're not more likely to be shot. But
But I'm drawing that distinction, right? Is the perception of danger of black individuals higher and disproportionate to the actual threat in this country? I think that is true.
You'd have to explain to me what the actual threat is. Let's take New York. I read the New York Times. Yeah, yeah. I hate to be saying this, but just the way any logical person would approach this. And I know you know just to say to spin something out in a logical order is to risk your career. You know, but
this is a safe space.
No, it's not. It's going.
Noam doesn't have a boss.
That according to the New York Times. 98.6% of violent crime in New York City is non-white. 98.6%. Now that's, except when I got a 98 on a test, my father wanted to know what I got wrong.
Well, so
basically,
I
98% is considered to be 100.
So I want to know the statistics, the nature of that statistics in terms of what you're describing. Because is that 98.6% of reported crimes?
Yes, obviously it's reported.
Well, right,
crime.
But so then that already. I'm just saying that already. Implicates
you're
going
to look at this
bias.
And you're going to try to squirm out of it. But the fact
I'm not trying
is,
to squirm out of it. I'm
the
just
fact
trying
is
to
that
be precise
by the only the only crime stats we have are the crime stats, and we do know that black people are murdered 20-1 to white people, and mostly by reportedly. Maybe there's a whole bunch of white people being murdered. That are not
sure,
being reported,
but
black people being murdered by. In other words, we know other things. We know that as a nation, we feel that we owe the black community super extra attention and resources because we feel that they have problems which are the fault of our history, which we need to fix. We say all that. Hold on, let me finish. We say all that, and then we on the other side of our mouth we say. Why are you saying that black people are any different than white people? Why would you think that? No, their crime stats are exactly the same. Well, if their crime stats are exactly the same, then maybe they don't need all this extra attention we're giving them. The fact is, we know that it's a terrible life-threatening position to be an African-American male. And that's not because they're getting shot by white people. And
well, it's not only because they're being shot by white
It's not in any real way. This is Nate Silver wrote about this. We had him on this podcast. So I am not saying anything that's heartless. I'm saying is that the fact is that the inner city is a real thing and it's crime ridden, especially in other cities, in Baltimore or whatever it is, in Chicago. So if you, and in Philly, and if you live in one of those cities, how do you teach these people to say, ignore what you know is the reality? But you have don't be scared of somebody who fits the profile and be equally scared of, some white guys in a suit. Actually, you would hope they wouldn't be scared of a black guy in a suit. And I have experience with this. I used to have when I used to live with Rosalind, my black girlfriend. And, was clear to me, like, I could dress any old which way and walk into Tiffany's. And she felt she had to dress up to walk into Tiffany, right? Mm. So I understand the reality.
Right. And so again, I'm not going all the way in terms.
But you're never going to teach people otherwise if the world doesn't. If the world teaches them a different lesson, they can do all the classes you want.
But isn't that exactly the reason why Starbucks having a class on implicit bias for employees who are seeing, you know, every walk of life walk into Starbucks, to train them? Look, just because you see some guy who's black and wearing a hoodie. Doesn't mean he has a gun. No, right.
Yeah. Scary.
I just clutched my purse.
we're talking about one incident in, you know.
Sure.
But if you're in the airport and you see a Middle East, won't you want him to be selected, or you want a black guy or a white guy to be selected? I mean, let's be. I want the Middle East to be selected. If I'm in the airport and I see somebody. Looks like me. I also want him first to be selected.
So I want to just bracket off that conversation entirely for a second and just focus on exactly what you said, right? We live in a culture where there is this expectation where black people do face greater danger from society generally.
Mm-hmm.
They do, right? So, like, just look at drug statistics. Black people use drugs, same rate as white people. Every study shows that. But 35% of the people arrested for using drugs are black. Half of the people actually prosecuted then for using drugs are black. And 2/3 of the people serving time for drug possession are black, right? So are they wrong to feel that they live in a certain state?
No, they're right. Noam said a black guy in a suit is not going to make any difference.
Well,
like, they're
going
to treat him the same way like a guy with a hoodie.
I don't think they would.
But if you're living in that world, right, where you're under a constant suspicion to the point of threat in many situations, isn't the obvious way to try and correct that problem on a social on a society-wide basis, to actually say, look, corporations are going to train their employees to not rely on their natural biases to assume that every black guy in a hoodie is going to rob the store.
Yeah,
assume that the black guy in a hoodie may just be going to track back.
But now here's the thing about the Starbucks
incident. I agree with you.
I don't believe, it doesn't seem clear to me, and again, we don't have the manager here. She didn't necessarily think that they were going to rob the store or present a danger. Maybe she just felt she wanted to enforce the if you don't order, you can't be here.
Right. What's interesting about, I would say the overwhelming majority of all these cases, not all of them, but an overwhelming majority, is that these things usually happen in incidents where somebody wasn't acting actually properly. It's not usually some guys were minding their own business, sipping coffee. Similarly with the cops. How many of these incidents were involved where the guy really was resisting, really wasn't answering, really was escalating the situation? You would think we'd see more situations with cops where somebody was just behaving himself perfectly well. There have been some. There's a guy shot in the back. You know, there are murderers out there. But by and large, I would feel so much better about this incident if these guys had behaved the way I know I would have behaved. I would have gone in, can I use the bathroom? No, it's for customers. We've all been told customers only, right? This is not something only black people. Let's not pretend only black people have been told customers only.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, oh, no problem. Can I get a Coke? Or I might say, please, I'll get a bottle of water. Then I sit down. You have to order, take a table. I would never in my life say, I'd say, oh, okay.
Sure, and again, I don't know a damn thing.
So when I hear all these other facts, I say, maybe it was racism.
So,
and if it was, they should fire her.
So the last thing before we have to make.
But you follow me, right?
I do follow you, and I think this is the thing that I'm just cautious about. I'm not saying anyone's wrong. Again, I don't know a thing about this, but that in situations where black people end up being the victims of police violence, for example, or like in this situation, and again, I'm not saying anyone did anything wrong. But I think there is an inclination, particularly by the press and sort of casual observers like us, to start digging into every detail and looking at what the, what the black guys in this situation did wrong. Whereas we're in Greenwich Village, right? Walk out on a Friday night after midnight, you're going to see some completely drunk and stoned white kid being like obnoxious and completely inappropriate, either in this restaurant or out on the street. And do you think in that situation the cop is going to shoot him? I just Intuitively, I think no. I think it's less likely.
They're going to give him.
He gets a benefit of the doubt.
Yeah,
yes. I agree with that.
So last thing before we have to Skype call a guest, but my final point that I want to make about this is I don't think it's the incident itself that matters at this point. It's how Starbucks is dealing with it. It's superficial, and it's just like they're trying to make, this is not the right way to do it. You know?
Can I answer this? Yeah. And is it? There's at least two possibilities here, maybe only two. The boss, whoever it is of Starbucks, says to himself, we have a real problem here. This woman, my manager, treated these people. He investigated. This is racism. I need to address this. That's one possibility. Or the other possibility is, shit, this is really bad PR. Let's pretend.
So as a business owner, what do you think it was?
I suspect that the guy is just pretending.
Second, a third
possibility, which is not necessarily better, but I think at least worth considering, is that the owner of Starbucks knows that incidents like this happen all the time in Starbucks and every other company. He has something of a social conscience, and he says, maybe this is a teachable moment. This gives me an opportunity to do that. Now, that may be corny, and that may be superficial. And I think there's something to that argument. But it's not necessarily cynical. And I think that is.
I would say that is by far the least likely.
Yeah. All right, let's go. Let's go. We're going to talk about. I agree with Dan 100%. So let's. We're going to talk about Syria and Trump and all the. I don't know if you guys know there was missiles.
Can we all just say something? Because I think it needs to be said to anybody listening. I think every one of us, in our own way, I hope, except maybe Modi, wants to be on the right side of this issue.
Absolutely.
Of course.
And we can only imagine the day to day humiliation of. That African Americans go through, and I don't think any of us are denying it. On the other hand, most of us want to be fair to the Starbucks employee.
Yeah,
right.
And nobody can know this for sure.
Yeah, I would like more information.
I feel the same way about the women in Louis story. But go ahead.
Aziz was here last week.
Oh yes. Yeah, they cheered him.
We
should have talked about it on the radio.
Daryl was.
I wanted actually. Did he go on the stage?
He went on stage and cheered him.
He actually was here. Right after he left, I was sitting at the table eating wings, and he kind of like walked, and everyone at the Olive Tree was clapping for him in the side, and he shook hands and stuff.
He didn't order any wine though.
So we're going to talk about Trump and Syria. Do you guys know there was missiles attack on Syria?
I thought that was last time I was here. That was like a year ago.
Yeah, it was. It was the last time actually you were here, and we were talking. Yeah, you can call. We talked about it, and we talked about the international of what's going on. So we'll see.
What do you think about a Starbucks? Oh, never mind.
No, go ahead.
A Starbucks boycott because they are, in my mind, exacerbating racial tension by just assuming this was a racist incident and setting what I regard as a bad precedent.
What is a bad precedent, probably, but I don't like boycotts.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing? So, can you hear me well?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. So we have...
I have no idea what's being said.
Hello, can you hear me?
He's frozen.
Hello?
He's just holding still.
Or he could be holding still. Can you hear me?
Connect again. Maybe you don't need video. Maybe just do a regular...
Yeah.
Regular... take less bandwidth.
Yeah. So I want to ask you guys a question about what's behind Trump raising popularity recently.
He has raising popularity?
Yeah. Oh,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's like... Well,
how much? This is like... We should call Nate Silver.
Higher than Obama at the same time, they said.
I can't believe that.
That's what... At the same time, a year after.
Wow.
So,
are they just calling different people? I don't know how these things work.
That's funny. Yeah, so, but he is, he's been congratulating himself the whole time on Twitter.
See. Well, that's nothing new.
Yeah, no,
he's
sure.
Congratulating himself.
Yeah.
Maybe because Barbara Bush died.
Oh, did she die today?
Did Trump say anything about Barbara Bush?
He said
Barbara loved me.
I was her favorite.
But she was only a three.
I never thought that. Certainly didn't think.
Hey, how you doing? So we'll make a voice call. Is that better?
Hold on. I'm looking right here. Trump's approval rating is 39%.
That's pretty high for him. Basim, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can faintly hear you guys. I can hear myself.
We got you loud and clear, my man.
Okay, good. So we have Basim Rafai. He is an executive board member at the Syrian American Council. Welcome to the show. And he previously worked as a foreign policy advisor on the Hillary Clinton campaign. He's been all over CNN, NBC, Al Jazeera.
Boo.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We have comedian Modi, comedian Lou, comedian Dan Natterman, Noam Dorman, of course. And we have a senior attorney at the Department of Defense, Michel Paradis, is here as well. So welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, here we go. So, first question, welcome to the show. And first question is, what's the damage in Syria right now? Did they actually hit the targets that they said they're going to hit it before or not?
They did hit the targets that they said they were going to be hitting. And it's funny how the Russians are trying to make so much out of nothing here and say, we shot down so many of the U.S. Missiles that came towards Syria. That wasn't true at all. In fact, actually, the Syrian defense, the air defenses, they actually shot after we had finished with shooting our Tomahawk missiles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they didn't take anything down. We hit exactly what we meant to hit.
So what was the difference between this shot and the attack last year?
So the attack last year was actually more of just a show. It's not that it didn't do anything good. It definitely was positive. It took out 20% of his air force. That's a big deal to Syrians on the ground who are dying from that air force. Uh-huh. But the point of this one was to actually prevent Assad from being able to use chemical weapons. So what we targeted was specifically his chemical weapons depots and his manufacturing plants and his logistical operations specifically on chemical weapons. So it was much more targeted in that sense. And it really degrades his ability to be able to use chemical weapons. But it does not stop him from using chemical weapons. It was really more of just a deterrence. If we went further, it would have been a lot stronger. It would have been actually a lot more impactful. But, you kind of, as Syrians, you get what you get right now.
Leave him wanting more.
So you, I know you're not in Syria now, but how is the Syrian people think? Do you think America is your side or the people? I'm talking about the people or against them.
So,
Is America evil or?
So the majority of Syrians, uh-huh. people who are with the opposition or against Assad, they all supported the U.S. strikes.
What percentage is that?
I'm sorry, what's that?
What's the percentage of that?
I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, uh-huh. But it's the majority of Syrians. Syrians who are in Damascus, and it's never going to be accurate to try and get a percentage, because Syrians who are in Damascus or in Latakia or in regime-held areas, they're never going to speak the truth. They're never going to speak their mind and say, hey, we're not with Assad. We support stopping the chemical weapons. They're never going to be able to say that. And when we saw what happened in Duma, when the regime came into Duma and took over the entire area, kicked out the opposition fighters, there was nobody left for the few people who stayed in Duma. And they have to say exactly what Assad wants them to say. If they don't say it, they kind of disappear. He'll kill them, he'll torture them, he'll put them in prison. They'll just go somewhere else.
Okay. So, Noam always have a point that you make about Obama wasn't able to protect Syria, and he could have. You know, do you guys feel that Trump is better for Syrian people than Obama? Like, is he helping? Does he have more effect than Obama?
So, I mean, as somebody who's, you know, voted democratically, and you know, I've never had a Republican candidate that I've been able to vote for. It's really strange for me to say this, but yeah, President Trump for Syrians in Syria has been better than President Obama has. I mean, that's not to say that he's, you know, great or anything like that. You know, we've let in 11 refugees this year. That's a terrible number. Under President Obama's policy, it's not like we let in a large number either, but there was a large discrepancy there. But what President Obama did was he called out the red line, which gave the Syrians hope that the United States would back them. And then when he kind of just let that slide, that made it worse. That gave Assad and Russia and Iran the ability. Well, it gave Russia and Iran the door to walk into Syria, but it gave them also the mindset that they can operate inside of Syria with impunity. That's the more dangerous part. And that's why it's actually more of a global issue than just a Syrian issue. Because now you look at, you know, dictators all over the world. You look at Kim Jong-un. He can do whatever he wants now. He has a blueprint from Assad.
Can I actually ask you a question, just challenging that a little bit? And I'm no defender of Obama or his, you know, policy towards Syria. But in 2013, the Obama administration's approach after the chemical weapons attack was to have the Assad regime turn over and ultimately destroy large-scale chemical weapons stockpiles, including sarin gas, which I understand was used last week. And Assad didn't use chemical weapons again for, what, another 4 years. And the war in Syria from 2013 to 2016-17, when it became part of the Trump administration, or the responsibility of the Trump administration, changed a lot during that time. Russia's involvement, right? Russia was not significantly involved in 2013. It is in 2017, 2018. And so to the extent the Obama administration's approach was to attempt to use the threat of force to take away Assad's chemical weapons capacity, at least for at that time, what, for 3-4 years. And the Trump administration's approach in this airstrike is to diminish Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons capacity, using missiles instead of diplomacy. How different, actually, is the approach insofar as Trump, a week before the chemical weapons attack, said, we're heading out of Syria. It's not our business anymore. ISIS is gone. Hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to be a downer. I was just asking.
Sleeping.
Are you there?
That was a white noise machine. I just...
Oh, that's a good, it's a good question. You haven't... Did you hear the question?
I didn't actually hear the question.
Should Starbucks close? That was where we were. Let me just a little lighter. Just
I'll let him ask the question again. But
we only have an hour.
that Obama was effective
for four years.
And how different is Obama really than Trump?
All right, so I'm gonna laugh a little bit at the Obama was effective for 4 years.
Good.
I laughed too. You couldn't hear. Well, go ahead.
To be clear, but only on the chemical weapons question. Like, if the thing that upsets us is the use of chemical weapons. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
So if the thing that upsets us is the use of chemical weapons, the Obama administration made it its policy objective to degrade and ultimately eliminate or limit Assad's chemical weapons capacity, and more or less appears to have done so for 3 to 4 years, because it's not until 2017 that it's obvious that Assad is using chemical weapons again. And so to the extent Trump's use of force this past week was intended to degrade solely for the purpose of degrading chemical weapons capacity, how different actually is it from Obama's policy?
Okay, so... I think I also heard you say that for 3-4 years, Assad didn't use chemical weapons. That's not true, actually. Assad has used chemical weapons hundreds of times. We're just not making the distinction. between sarin gas and chlorine gas.
True.
He's used chlorine lots and lots of times, but there's sort of this like gray line when it comes to chlorine, because chlorine, we think about it from a household use.
There, swimming there pools.
Are conventional uses for it. But when it's weaponized and it's used intentionally to cause suffocation, that's when it's an international crime and it's illegal. And that's how Assad's been using it. But Russians have kind of been giving them the cover to be able to continue using it. And because it's in this like gray area, for some reason, the international community seems to look the other way about that one. But when he uses sarin gas, let's rain hell down on him for, you know, one night and slap him on the wrist and say, hey, guy, don't do it again.
Interesting.
It doesn't work.
The question I had is in regards to using chemical weapons to begin with, what is the advantage of using that if you are Assad? Because it doesn't seem like it's very good for PR.
You know, I'm going to try PR. To answer that. Obviously, he's the more...
Yeah, I don't think that's really good for PR for anyone at any point.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with Modi.
So I don't think you're right.
Let's look at Duma real quick.
It's terrifying.
The most recent time where he used sarin gas. First off, he tried to hide the use of sarin gas by mixing it in with chlorine. He thought he was being clever or some shit. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand, you know, if he thought he was going to get away with that. So you have Duma. It was the last bastion area in Ghouta that they were still holding out, and it was the last area that Assad needed to get rid of. They were pushing back. Ghouta is largely deserted now. People are now living in Afrin in northern Syria or in the suburbs of northern Aleppo in AFD camps up there. But Duma was the only area that was resisting and that was pushing back. And it was kind of just like Assad said, you know what? Fuck it.
Yep.
This is, you know, this is the last area. I'm tired of dealing with these people. I've already won.
Yep.
I can hide it by using the chlorine gas because I've used it so many other times just this year. And, you know, I had no repercussions. So here, I'm going to do it again. And, you know.
So back to what he was saying
he
before.
Got caught.
I think it was.
But he also got what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
He now occupies Duma immediately, 24 hours after he used the sarin gas on the area. They retreated. They left the area.
And then PR wise for him, it's amazing because you see this video as people marching in the street, victory, victory, victory. His people, the people that support him, are even more now supportive of him, like, oh, the America's the worst, bombing us and this and that. And then you see the Russians, we didn't know how much behind him they were. We figured like, yeah, they want the gas and whatever. They called the UN meeting.
Yeah.
And they like, we are really behind this guy. We want a meeting at the UN. You know, for him, it was a PR genius move. Genius move.
Yeah, I mean, what they're doing is they're trying to create this air of confusion. They're going to say, hey, we have the opportunity to use the fog of war to create confusion. And now people don't really know what the truth is because we've distorted it. We've created this area where people don't really necessarily know or understand what is the truth. And I mean, we saw that exactly the day after the U.S. strikes. There was an increase of 2,000% by Russian bots, right, and the Russian electronic army.
So I just said, yeah.
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 Listen, isn't this all Obama's fault? No. Here's my narrative. You tell me. This is my narrative. You tell me.
Listen, you have some Syrians, and they will tell you.
Let me tell you my narrative, and the professor can tell me where I'm wrong. Colin Powell famously said before the Iraq invasion, if you break it, you own it. He was right. We did break it. And Bush You can argue whether this was cynical or noble motivation, but they went in there and they fucked it up. We had Fred Kaplan here who said that he thinks actually if they had done it differently, they might have pulled it off. That the anyway, so we broke it. Obama came into office with this ridiculous notion that because he's a new president, none of this stick. It's like a new, what sticks to America doesn't stick to him. So he could now.
New car smell.
What's that?
New car smell.
Yeah, so he could now make policy without the strings attached to him of America's responsibilities. So he says, fuck it, we're out of here. And he was warned by everybody close to him, Hillary, Petraeus, the generals, everybody said, you're going to leave a vacuum there. That's, and then hold that thought. At the same time, every world leader is taking the temperature on this guy and saying, this guy, more than anything in the world, does not want any armed confrontation. He's announcing, yeah, he's going to stay in Afghanistan, but he's announcing when we're going to leave. He's negotiating with Iran, but clearly he fears confrontation with Iran more than the Iranians do. So, Stephen, what are you doing, man? I'm looking for a charge. So he's advertised to the whole world that he's scared and he's pulling out. And then they cross his red line. We don't really believe this red line. And then he turns it over to the Russians. And 450,000 Syrians die. And there was only one person in the world who could have prevented it. And he could have prevented it easily and cheaply. And that was Barack Obama. And he did not do it. And I don't see any argument I've ever heard not to put this squarely on him. And as opposed to noble motives, which may be the invasion of Iraq, cowardly. Now you tell me where I'm wrong.
No, honestly, you're really not wrong there. And seriously, I said it just a moment ago. If you ask Syrians, they almost squarely place the blame on President Obama, and they're not really wrong about that.
It could have been so at the time. I'm sorry to interrupt you. At that time when it started, we were the only ones there. We could have created a no-fly zone. So easy for us at that point. Obama, we got to get out.
Even you know, every single year that was going by, his own advisors were saying, you know what, like, it was easier last year, it's harder now. Yeah. And then the next year would pass and they say, it was easier last year, it's harder now. Dude, don't you get it?
Yeah.
It's going to keep getting worse.
I think the lessons of world history, they don't all line up in one direction. There are clearly mistakes of overusing force. And there's mistakes of underusing force. But I'd say in general, the bigger mistakes come from the underuse of force. And you see this
at the right time.
In Iran getting the bomb, and Korea getting the bomb, and you name it. And time and time again, the people who stand up to these guys while the opposition party thinks they're going to cause World War III or whatever, lo and behold, the problem melts away.
So can I?
Go ahead.
No, please. You know more than
I was just going to say, it's funny because everyone was calling for, this is going to cause World War III. You know that Putin recently kind of, he's saying that he wants to re-engage in talks with President Trump after the strikes, after the increased sanctions. He doesn't have the political will. He doesn't have the capability to be attacking the United States, UK, France, Turkey, Qatar, Israel. Come on, it's not realistic that this is going to cause World War III between Russia and all these countries. Sure, they're going to instigate it, and they're going to try and play this game and talk a big game, but they're not going to do anything in the end. Look at the strikes from Israel. There were two times where they struck Syrian bases, and the Russians said, "If you strike, we're going to attack you." There was no retaliation.
But they're also
the ability to.
They're striking because Iran's giving Hezbollah weapons, you know.
Don't say Israel.
Don't
go ahead.
don't defend him, Modi.
But, you know,
I want to let Michelle, I'm sorry, forgive me. I just want to let Michelle say something because, you know, he's an expert in it.
I have a spot at 11:45. What do you want?
So let me begin in 1832. No. So, like, first of all, I actually personally do entirely agree with your analysis of Obama's weakness and then a weak response in Syria. So I'm not defending Obama. However, if I was defending Obama, I would say what you called for, for example, in 2013, right, when he crossed the red line, is exactly what the Obama administration did, at least in some part, in Libya in 2011. And the question is the question facing the policymakers in 2013, is Libya better off today than it had been in 2010 under Gaddafi? That was a choice they had to make. Was our intervention in creating chaos in Libya, which can persist to this day, a civil war that persists to this day, is that better than the situation that would have prevailed had we left Muammar Gaddafi in place? Now, I think they made the wrong call. I entirely agree with you. I think the Obama administration had a lot of military and even diplomatic and sanctions options that he didn't avail himself of to deal with the Syrian crisis earlier and better. But if I'm a trying to just be fair to the people in the room making the hard decisions, if I'm choosing between the total chaos that Libya had descended to by 2013, or if that's at least the most recent lesson I can draw from, I'm going to at least hesitate, and I should hesitate. That doesn't necessarily mean I shouldn't act, but I should hesitate.
Now, I don't know the Libya story, at least I can't remember, but I know that we promised Gaddafi that if he gave up his weapons of mass destruction, no harm would come to him.
Sure.
And so, then we didn't live up to our word, did we?
Well, right. We didn't live up
to our word. Who was that? Was that Bush or Obama? That was Obama, too.
So in the context of the same Arab Spring that led to the uprising in Syria, Libya had an uprising against Muammar Gaddafi. And we ultimately decided that we, faced with the very real possibility that Muammar Gaddafi was going to commit genocide against rebel forces in places like Benghazi, we supported those rebel forces with air support, primarily from NATO. And I think we thought that NATO would probably take the French, for example, or the English would take a much more leading role in managing the peace than they ultimately did. But nevertheless, we backed the insurgency against Gaddafi. And to some extent, we ultimately backed the insurgency against Mubarak in Egypt. And what we faced then from the what we saw in the aftermath of the Arab Spring was chaos. And so to the extent the Obama administration is confronted with the choice between an evil son of a bitch like Bashar al-Assad or the chaos we've seen in Libya, the chaos we were seeing at the time in Egypt, that's at least a harder decision than it may be now, where we know 5 years later how the story
turns
out.
Yeah, but I think you're narrowing, you're focusing on too narrow an issue here. Because I believe that every other troublemaker in the world watches these things. And when they when they see the United States let events take their own course, that we become a bystander, then we buy ourselves 100 times the problem. Because there is flashpoints ready to blow up everywhere in the world, and many of them are avoided simply because they felt the United States is not going to tolerate it. As soon as they realize the United States checks out.
So that is true to a point, but I'll give you another just counterexample. Again, I actually don't disagree with this analysis of the Obama administration's failure in Syria. I'm simply saying it was a harder call than it obviously
seems
to be
today.
They're
hard calls, for sure.
And I'll give you an example, is that supposedly, reportedly, Vladimir Putin has watched the video of Muammar Gaddafi being dragged out of a hole and executed like 10 times. And watching the execution of Gaddafi mobilized him to utterly crack down on the Eastern Spring, I guess is what you could call it, in places like Ukraine.
Not Chechnya,
but so much in Moscow, right? Mm-hmm. There were massive pro-democracy protests in Moscow in 2012 when Vladimir Putin was attempting to get a third term as president. And the story of Muammar Gaddafi being ass-raped and then shot, on
Did you say
video.
Ass-raped?
Cornhole, please, cornhole.
Cornhole, and then shot. And that being posted on YouTube was a strong incentive for Vladimir Putin to say, fuck it, I may as well crush this while I can. Because if I do not want to end up like Muammar Gaddafi.
So yeah, again, but it's different for Russian than, like, we, like, you know, we like asses.
Well, no, he wants to say something.
Yeah, good.
That's exactly the point I was making, is that what's happening in Syria, what Assad is doing in Syria, is his blueprint for dictators around the world. That's exactly what he's saying, is Putin's looking at that and he's saying, well, fuck it. Here's what I might as well do. And here's the world that I get to operate in without repercussions.
Look, I agree. In my lifetime, I've seen the assurances go wrong. We have a deal with North Korea. They're not going to get a bomb. We have a deal with Iran. I mean, it's farcical already that these dumb politicians think that a piece of paper without the threat of force is going to bind these dishonorable actors in the world, let alone the honorable actors will still fall into it. And we keep making the mistake over and over and over again. And maybe the world's going to end because of it, you know?
I have a question in regards to the insurgencies. So, you know, if you get rid of the strong man, the bad guy, obviously there is a vacuum there no matter what. And when it comes to Libya, who, you know, what were the groups part of that insurgency? And then when it comes to Syria, what are the groups making up that insurgency as well? Because if you get rid of somebody and then ISIS comes in, it's like, oh man, what did we just do?
Well, that's one of the things that ultimately happened in Libya, right?
Before. Definitely happened in Egypt.
Nope.
I'll let Hadam deal with Egypt, but Egypt's another example, right? Where you have various, you know, factions, and those tend to be regional. Those tend to be tribal.
Yeah, but Egypt is an example of bad foreign policy from the U.S. You know. They wanted to support the Muslim Brotherhood, thinking that this is democracy, and then it turns on their head. Okay. But it's not military action or chaos at that point. You know?
Give us a quick rundown of each country. Syria, I know there's Alawites and Sunnis. It's a whole mix of these differences that are taken very seriously, right? Tribal differences. Yeah. In Libya,
it's basically an east-west divide. So you have, and then
are they the same brand of
yeah, they're all
Islam?
The same. Yeah, they're all the same. Islam, same, yeah. But then you also have Salafists.
So I think the question is, if Assad went down, who's going to take over in Syria?
That's the question.
That is not ISIS.
So that was actually what I wanted to go back to Libya about, is when you made that Libya argument, we're making the assumption that the only option is to use military force and then to walk away, just like what happened. But I think there's a parallel option to be going with that, and that's to be supporting civil societies and to be supporting people who are going to support in Syria a free, democratic, secular, pluralistic society, people who are going to rebuild Syria. We do have those options in Syria. There's the ITLAF, there's the HNC, the High Negotiating Committee. They're all comprised of people who are well-known throughout Syria, who are supporting of all these things.
But who's going to be their competition? You know, in other words,
so supporting them.
Okay. All right, so I have a question that it's different than sudden this. It's about refugees. I have a theory, and let me know what you think. I think that in the beginning, refugees should not come to the U.S. I think the refugees should go to Egypt, Qatar, you know.
I know where this theory is going.
No, because I feel that, you know, we have a lot in like, for example, the U.S. protect Qatar, okay? That's the only way they still exist. But yet, they don't have their share with helping the refugees, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all that. So why are you with or against that the refugees should be to go into the Arabic neighborhood countries first before coming here? Or is it here is the right choice for them?
I think they should go wherever it is that's best for them to be going. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple points. Is, you know, they have gone to Turkey, they've gone to Jordan, they've gone to Lebanon. Some of the other Arab countries don't accept them, actually.
They had a good experience in Egypt, though.
Ridiculous. So there is actually an area of Syrians in Egypt.
Yeah, very popular.
I have my own families in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
You know, my family is spread out throughout the world now.
Yeah.
I have members of my own family in Egypt, and they're finding it very, very difficult because they're finding that, you know, they're not quite welcome, and, you know, they can't get jobs there.
Are they being treated in Starbucks?
I'll give you a very, very clear example. my cousin who worked for Ernst & Young in Syria as an analyst in the petroleum industry, went to Egypt, hasn't been able to find any work, and he's now you know, selling food on the street.
There's a syndrome in, I forgot the name of it, in Norway, Sweden.
Yeah.
There's a name for it, for these men that are like, there's a, it's Gjuchkekaken syndrome, and it's like they're just laying in bed with their eyes open, completely depressed, grown men, families, and nothing to do. It's a very sad thing.
So that's one of the problems of going to the Arab nations is they've been very racist against the Syrians, actually, and they don't let them work. In Jordan, they're actually not allowed to work. In Lebanon, they're not allowed to work. You know, so they're just trying to find somewhere where they can make some money for their family, to support their families. That's all what it really comes down to.
And the fact that
I'll tell you, I spent a lot of time. I was in Greece for 6 months building the UNHCR refugee camp on the island of Lesbos there. And I personally spoke to thousands of refugees coming through. And I think every single one I spoke to said they wanted to go back home.
Did you say Lesbos?
Yes, that's the island of Lesbos, a real place.
It's a real place.
I know.
I was on Mykonos. I got sunburned.
Well, can I lighten up this? So I want to tell you something that I was supposed to be on a panel today about something about activism, next week, about activism by Ford Motor Company. And they called me today and they told me who I was going to be on the panel with. And I was supposed to be on a panel with a woman named Angela Luna. Do you know who that is?
I don't know.
Okay. She's a woman. She's a fashion designer. She's a fashion designer. She's got some press who was inspired by the plight of the Syrian refugees and decided to create outerwear.
Right.
You heard about this?
Yes.
Would help Syrian refugees. So it's like a tent would become a fashionable gown.
No, they make it into garments or bracelets or stuff. People, so you're buying and they get money for it.
And I said, this is, I find this unsettling, that this seems to me to be a piggybacking commercialism on supposed humanitarianism, that I can't even imagine wearing some Park Avenue rich lady wearing this outfit that's inspired by the needs of Syrian refugees. It reminds me of like some like fashionable gas masks during the Holocaust, and I refused to do it. And the lady on the other end of the phone was like talking to me like I was some madman, you know? And I said, well, maybe I'm wrong. Like, you know, I'd like to meet this woman. But, you know, in liberal circles, they just nod their head like, yes, this is such good. It's so good that you're doing this. So good you're doing this. But I don't know. Have you heard about it? What did you think about this Syrian refugee garment stuff? It seems to me that she's just trying to make money by looking like she cares.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard about it. It's not, you know, I've seen a lot of negative things out of the humanitarian side of things, where it's almost become a business, you know, where in IRC you have refugees who have come to the United States. Well, the IRC is billing them for their airline tickets and things like that. And meanwhile, and they have an interest package, and the airline tickets are crazy expensive, more than we would have paid. You know, they're making money off of the refugees. So I've seen the negative side of things. I can definitely see your point. But on the flip side, I'm gonna end up supporting anything that's at least attempting to help people who are in a position of need. Because I'll tell you, I've seen these people, and I've seen the condition that they've come into Europe with, and they have nothing.
Heart-wrenching.
Especially when they're coming into Greece. The smugglers, they'll often pull out a gun on them right before they get on the boat, and they make them give them all their valuables, money, jewelry, everything that they have to give to the smugglers. Mm-hmm. So they're coming with literally nothing.
So what you know, in your opinion, what would be, or do you guys have a solution for the refugees coming to the U.S. in a way that
Can I ask one question before that?
Why are you interrupting my question? Is it important before that question?
It's a bigger question, yeah.
Well, I want to interrupt both of you guys interrupting.
Whoa, now.
This is a crazy coincidence. It has to be. But as we're speaking here, I I'm getting an alert on my computer that's telling me that my Apple ID's been hijacked and being used in Russia, actually.
What?
I find it hilarious. It's got to be a crazy coincidence, but it's just funny.
Did they download Angry Birds?
Maybe.
Sergey, get off.
Hold
get
on one second. Vladimir, you're too obvious.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm just, I don't know. I don't know if we made this point before, but, you know, God forbid, if the Jews of fill in the blank anywhere in the world, England, France,
Palestine.
If they were all of a sudden deported or became refugees, the entire Jewish world would go berserk and get them placed and get them jobs. You Muslims, these are your Muslims. Stop saying Arab. These are Muslim brothers, aren't they? Isn't that a isn't that a thing? Hey,
I don't like his attitude. Hudson.
I don't like his attitude either. Well, no, you know, not every religious group has the same solidarity as the Jews do. The Jews are very, very tiny, tiny, tiny group of 15 million or so people. That do have a solidarity that is famous and sometimes resented because people say, well, we're more loyal to each other than we are to the countries that we live in. But that's the exception, not the rule. Certainly, Christians don't feel that, I don't think, kind of solidarity on a worldwide basis with each other. And, you know, they've certainly been fighting wars against each other for many, many centuries.
Well, the Jews have the better pools at the JCC. Like, you guys definitely.
Well, we belong to the Italian
but not
center
the better gene pools.
Oh, shit.
But, you know, the Jews, right. The Jews being a very, very tiny, tiny group, Modi, are the exception.
That's the opposite of the. You're unanswering my question. You would think so. There's so many Muslims in the world to say, hey, our Muslim
well,
brothers
you
are
have,
suffering.
You have two in the show right now, Basil and myself. We're trying to do something. And the problem is you only hear the voices that the media are going to cover, which is the voices that trying to ignore everything, just like with the terrorist thing. And not to mention, you know, with Muslims, people have different definitions for Muslims themselves.
You guys have not hit on the answer. I'm going to tell you the answer.
Here we go.
These are dictatorships. They're not operating by anything other than what's best for the dictator. And he doesn't want any other population coming into his country because it could cause trouble.
That's absolutely
nothing to do with Muslim, Jewish, nothing. That's the way it is.
And can I make an America First argument for refugees? Because we tend to think, like with this tent turning into a dress or something case, that refugees are a charity case and that it's like we're such good people for thinking about refugees and wanting them in this country. I hope this doesn't sound bad, but again, from a purely American First standpoint, if you are the United States, and Syria has essentially burned to the ground. Who are the people who are able to leave Syria and make their way to the United States? Are they the, you know, whatever Trump called the Mexicans?
Are they
the bad hombres? No, they're the doctors. They're the, you know, the investment bankers. They're the engineers. We, you know, from the standpoint of the United States, we're missing a massive opportunity to bring in the next generation of highly motivated foreign people who have, you know, an opportunity to make the American dream and make this country great again. Because otherwise the entire country is going to turn into Detroit.
I was extremely sympathetic to your point. I was really thought they were not taking in nearly enough refugees until this risk of terrorism really seemed to increase. In which case, I'm sorry, I buy it. I think it's risky.
So Basso, what do you think? Which one?
Even beyond that, I mean, if you look at what's happening in Europe, where you have people who are saying that they're refugees but are actually migrants, so you have these two words that keep going back and forth, and single young men, you know, crossing over into Cali? I forget what it is in England, and all that. So that's a scary thing too, where you have the people who need the help who are not getting the help because others are passing.
We're going to take in 5,000, 10,000 refugees. We could have gone over there and saved 500,000 and not have to even worry about the refugee problem. It's crazy what we did. It's crazy.
I have a question just getting back to what you said about the refugee, about the opportunity that America has to bring in our next generation of movers and shakers. And people say this a lot, but does that not give short shrift to the people that are already here and saying Americans and I think your friend over at the Wall Street Journal made this point. We're basically saying that white America is worthless and we need to import new people because the people that are already here suck.
No, it's not saying the people here already here suck. It's that this country has been built on the entrepreneurial spirit of people who have come from desperate circumstances all around the world and made this country much better, has made America great, right? If we were still the same basic population, if we had the same immigration policies that the America Firsters are now advocating, half of us would be speaking German. The rest of us would be speaking English. We'd all be old, and we have a population of about 50,000 people. Our GDP would be about a, you know, maybe a billion or two. We would have ceded leadership around the world to any number of other countries who have far more dynamic populations than we do. And to top it all off, our food would be terrible, right? Like we have, you know, I mean, it's a cliche, but we are a melting pot, right?
Yeah, the hummus really improves things.
So Basil, back to my question, which is the important question. Do you have, or the Syrian American Council, do you guys have a vision of how we can help the refugees come in here without, the worries of some ISIS sneaking in and stuff like that?
So I think that's a common fear of people. I mean, I know someone else had mentioned it about how you saw people going into Europe and you saw, the real risk, the terror risks that had come up in Europe. But there's a difference between Europe and the United States, and that's that the vetting process for people to enter into the United States, for Syrians specifically, is really difficult.
Yeah.
And I just can't understand how anyone would be able to get through that process, and we still have a security risk with them. We haven't had a single issue with any refugee that's come through so far.
Yeah. It's not an issue.
Yeah. Because of our vetting process, whereas the ones who are going through Europe, I mean, I'll tell you that they can easily lie and produce fraudulent documents, which is what's happening.
I mean,
one of those boats that I brought in Lesbos, it legitimately was a boat full of Cubans.
No.
Wow, they got lost. Wow, they got
and
lost.
And I got to talk from a personal experience. Like this country is so beautiful. Mira, but sometimes
estamos en Lesbos.
Yeah, I started speaking Spanish when I heard them speaking.
Oh my god!
Oye, qué pasó?
How come we're saying America is beautiful? Go ahead.
Yeah, from my personal experiences, America is so beautiful that you come here sometimes and you forget your mission and you just kind of and you kind of like mix with the crowd. So
what are you talking about?
Well, do you guys have any questions? Any more questions for Basil?
No, I was out of my depth. I mean, the Starbucks shit I can talk about, but
this was definitely.
Well, Basil, thank you so much. And we're going to have you, in the studio soon. Do you want to share your information or if somebody needs to help with the, we already have in our website, Dr. Basil's organization. So if somebody want to help with the Syrian refugee...
What's your Apple ID? I want Instagram. Yeah.
or if you want to share your Apple ID.
It's already all over the place.
Yeah, go ahead.
But you can go to our website, the sacouncil.com, and you can see we have action items, and there are ways that you can get involved in having a unified voice. But go check out our website. It's the best way to really get yourself involved, become a member, come to our advocacy day in D.C. We have training to help you be able to write op-eds, things like that, to amplify the voice of Syrian Americans. But I appreciate you guys having me on. And
might be worth mentioning that
I wish I could hear what you guys were saying in the beginning.
We'll send you the whole thing.
Yeah, consider yourself lucky.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
What might be worth mentioning that Congressional Medal of Honor winner Michael Mansour was at least part Syrian extraction.
So is Steve Jobs.
Yeah. You're right. Steve Jobs.
So is Seinfeld.
And I think Justin Amash.
No, but that's Congressman. Syrian,
Jerry Seinfeld. Yeah.
Syrian Jewish. If you want to throw that in, sure.
You have to put Jewish in it.
Yeah.
I think it's
thank God. Thank God for the Syrian. Leaders, his family was forced to flee. Seinfeld.
I think it's fascinating that we talked about it a lot in this show is like how Obama really, that was a great point that you made, a long time ago. And that's why I mentioned again, he could have stopped the whole thing. The other thing is like Trump guys is like,
But
I'm not a Trump supporter and I don't like Trump, but I'm saying like internationally, Trump is doing a great job in the Middle East and in the world. He really is. And this guy is saying it, the same thing.
Obama, you know, really messed up. Hillary would have been much better, I think.
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think she would have been cutting and running like shit. It's not her nature, it seems to me. I don't know, but.
But, you know, so.
I had no idea how many were killed. I didn't know that the number was that
half
high.
Half a million.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's insanity. And we just sat there twiddling our thumbs.
That's unbelievable.
And let the Russians. And well, I mean, it's unbelievable. But the big difference is everybody around him was warning him.
Yeah.
Not the opposition, his own people were warning him that what he was doing.
I can't believe Dan didn't back me on the Jewish. I was literally sure you didn't go, yes, Modi, and you just went.
Well, no, I'm just saying the Jews are a special, except a group with a tiny 10 million.
Can I say something about the Jewish issue and the Jewish question? I have a solution.
You can't.
Say, oh, no. Well, no.
You can't expect every religious group to act in that fashion, because we're not just a religious group. We're an ethnic group, and we're tiny.
In the Wall Street Journal this week, or maybe it's already last week, there was an article about anti-Semitism in Germany. I invite everybody to Google it. And it talked about how Germans were for the first time looking into land prices in Israel because they're thinking about leaving Germany. And this is
German Jews.
Yeah, German Jews. And this is the article implied, although it's not clear, that it's mostly because of Muslim immigrants into Germany. Where hold your thought. But and all through Europe now, we know that there's anti-Semitism increasing, and we know Dan and I both know French people who have left France because of anti-Semitism. And it really brought home to me, I think for the first time in my life, like, oh shit, Israel really is important. And except even today, except for in the United States of America, if you're Jewish, you may be in some peril. And if there were no Israel, so where could you go? You can't come. You can't even come to the United States.
So the president of, yep.
Wait. And it occurs to me that the Jews have made a mistake in the way they present this argument. What they constantly do is say, the Holocaust could happen again. The Holocaust could happen again. Which, of course, it could happen again. But I think probably the Holocaust is an outlier event in history. It's not likely to happen again anytime soon. And it's difficult to convince people that. And I think the argument is, no, it's not about that. It's that Jews are in peril of just being able to live safely anywhere in the world except the United States, even in Europe, mm-hmm. enlightened Europe, and Israel is all that stands between them and this horrible second-class citizen status. And it would be worse. They would treat them even worse if they knew they didn't have Israel to go to.
Well, the argument could be made that the reason anti-Semitism exists in the Arab world is because of Israel. Or at least
God, Dan.
That's a great argument.
Really? Were there no slaughters of the Jews prior to Israel in the Arab world?
Of course there were.
Yeah, but we just don't call it slaughters.
And a mistake Netanyahu made when he went to France after that big, there was some terrorist attack on the Jews there. Where?
Well, it was the Bataclan massacre. It wasn't just on the Jews.
There was the Bataclan, and then there was the Jewish market.
No, there was the Jewish, whatever it was, and he went to the Jewish people, and he said to them, he I don't know how he phrased it, but he said, you are all welcome to come to Israel. This is your land. Instead of you're French too and support your France and all that. But he just said that blatantly, and he got in trouble with the French government.
And he should. Yeah. Because this is one of the things we always tell, even politics here. If you take office, if Noam takes office, your loyalty will be to the U.S. or Israel if it comes to the point where you have to choose one.
What are you talking about? He's the prime minister of Israel. Is that the?
I'm talking about. Yeah, I know. But when he says, encourage citizens of other nations to have their loyalty first to Israel rather than their nation.
He didn't say that. He just said you have a place to go to.
Yeah.
He said you have a place to go to. He said that you are all welcome to Israel. He didn't say.
You just said he said you Israel first and then French.
I didn't say Israel first and then France. Those words never came out of my mouth.
They did. We're going to put them in.
Did I say Israel first and then France?
Oh, I wasn't listening.
Instead of,
no, you didn't say
it. I didn't say that.
No, was, that's
I,
even better.
I no, said like, he went, you he spoke at a synagogue in front of all these Jews, and he said to them, you know.
He just wants to talk about divided loyalty.
He said to them, you all here, you all, if you want, you have a country to go to, Israel.
Yeah, if you're tired of getting assaulted for wearing a yarmulke and being killed because you're a Jew.
He didn't say you're Israelis first. Mm-hmm. You're French Jews, and you're welcome to come to Israel.
You want
to
come, you can come. Listen, you don't want to come, don't come. I won't be insulted. Yeah.
I can't answer you. Who are you loyal to, your mother or your father? I would have to choose. You know, it's like that movie, The Good Child, where she's holding the two babies over the side. She doesn't know which child to let go of, you know.
Sophie's Choice.
No, The Good Child with Macaulay Culkin and Elijah Wood.
Yeah, yeah.
The Good Son. I love America more than anything in the world. And
your father did too, and he was born in another country and came here.
I would hope a scenario would never come where I would have to choose loyalty, but my loyalty would go with whatever's best for my children. That's what I would have to choose. Beyond country becomes your family.
You know, Dan and I, there's a tour that goes through Israel, comedians, they raise money for a cause, and the tour keeps growing and growing and growing, and it's because the community.
Can you give me the dates of the tour?
we're at an hour and 20 minutes now. If everybody's not sleeping yet, they're not going to go to
sleep. All of these people have, I speak to them afterwards, you know, and a lot of them are just people from England. I mean, a lot of people from England, France, Belgium, that moved to Israel. They were just like, they were tired of not being able to wear a yarmulke to walk to synagogue on Saturday and having police escorts. They're just like, who needs this? They moved to Israel.
But what is it about us that they find so annoying, Modi? That's what they would...
We definitely do not have enough time
for
that.
We can definitely end on that. All right, Modi, go ahead, Dan.
No, I'm just saying that it's a big topic, but we're delving into perhaps at another time.
More, do you want to share information?
Yes, I'll be performing at Starbucks throughout this. no, I'm going to be at the Village Lounge on the
Village Underground.
The Lounge.
Fat Black Pussycat.
Okay. The fat of color Pussycat Lounge on the 26th. Just go to the website and come, and then modilive.com.
Lou.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Lou on the Subway, and then check out my videos at We the Internet TV on Facebook and YouTube.
And Michelle?
You can follow me on Twitter at MD Paradis, Paradis.
There you go. Dan?
At Dan Natterman on Twitter.com.
And also your podcast.
Well, who cares? Oh, yeah, we have Live from the Table Thursday nights on Sirius XM Channel 99. Raw Doggy.
And livefromamericapodcast.com, and you can email us at comedyseller@livefrom.
Can we have America. Some? Can we have some outro music like real like costume or something like some real like intent? Blah, 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 like really like it would be nice to end with some real. Some,
okay, yeah, we get. We'll,
can you I'll do from now on like some real like.
All right, cool. Thank you very much. Good night.
You were listening to Live from America podcast. To contact us, please go to www.livefromamericapodcast.com. Brought to you by the Comedy Cellar and Rethink Production.